Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming out on such a cold day. It was really cold for a while, and then it got really nice for about 2 days, and now it's back. Kind of discouraging, I think. But that's okay. Hi, come on in, find a spot. If you'd like to stay for the lecture. Our intro class is once again full. No, sorry about that. If you come back next week a little earlier, you should be able to come to the intro.
Or on Tuesday night.
Or on Tuesday night. Good point. Same intro Tuesday night. So this morning, I would like to talk about the Buddha's six principles of cordiality. Did you know that the Buddha set forth six principles of cordiality? It's kind of an obscure teaching, I think. It's a nice topic, cordiality. Cordial means courteous and gracious, friendly and warm. These are nice things. And the root of cordial comes from Latin cor, or cord, meaning heart. So cordiality is of the heart. And I'd like to say right up front, this is not a strategically planned talk. It's not like I looked around and thought, wow, there's a real lack of cordiality here. I need to hit that pretty hard. That's not going on at all. I think that folks at Zen Center are remarkably kind and sweet and cordial, and we're getting along very well, and it's really wonderful. Things are harmonious. And I wish the same thing could be said for our society at large, because I think there are some problems out there. And I hear people talk a lot about sort of a lack of civility and a lack of cordiality that we seem to have these days. And I think it's true, and I think it's pretty obvious, really. I think it may have to do with our high degree of political polarization. We have people on TV, on these talk shows, kind of yelling at each other in a way that we probably wouldn't have seen a while back. Just kind of a lack of respect for people who disagree with you. It seems to have kind of entered the discourse. And you see it in internet comments. If you read a news story or something and you read the comments, which I usually don't do anymore because of this very problem, it seems the comments, people are doing these anonymously, and they can be just really mean, just vicious. And sometimes it seems like the default way to start out is, you're a complete idiot, you know, and then they go on from there. So this lack of civility, it's not new, though. It even happened in the Buddha's time, and that's what gave rise to this sutra, which is called the Kosambya Sutra. And this is from this book called The Middle-Length Discourses of the Buddha, a very thick book of talks given by the Buddha. That's where I found it. So this is part of the Pali Canon, which recounts the words of the Buddha himself. So this is this predates Zen. And it begins, "Thus have I heard," as many of these begin. And that's Ananda talking. Ananda, the Buddha's faithful servant who had wonderful powers of memory and is said to have been able to recount every word the Buddha ever said. So he starts out, "Thus have I heard." This is what I heard about the Buddha. On one occasion, the Blessed One, that's the Buddha, was living at Kosambi in Gosita's park. So Kosambi is a place in northern India. It's still there. I looked it up. And the Buddha spent his ninth rainy season there. So he's a little way into his long teaching career. I think his career, his teaching career lasted 45 years. So he's 10 years into his teaching career, still fairly young. Now, on that occasion, the bhikkhus, those are the monks, the Buddhist monks, at Kosambi had taken to quarreling and brawling and were deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers. They could neither convince each other nor be convinced by others. They could neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others. So we have these monks who are quarreling and brawling and throwing verbal daggers at one another. This is not a good thing. How did this come about? Well, it's in the historical record I've read a couple of different versions. They varied quite a lot. But here's what I put together. Here's the backstory on this quarreling. There was this monastery in Kasambi which stressed the Vinaya. And those are the rules for monks. Rules of behavior, which are really quite detailed. I think there are a couple hundred of them. And some monasteries would really stress these. Just follow the rules very closely. And that's a Dharma gate. And there was a visiting monk from another monastery that did not stress the Vinaya. So he didn't know all the rules. And he was visiting, and he, in the bathroom, he left some water in a basin. When he was done using the bathroom, he just walked out and he left some water in a basin. You know, water for washing your hands. He didn't know there was a rule against that, but there was. And it may sound like a silly rule, but they had a reason for it, which is that if you leave water in a basin, creatures may come to live in it, and then the next monk will either throw it out or maybe use the water and might have to kill those creatures. But it also could be a form of mosquito control. You know, it probably has a good reason. Anyway, he broke the rule. And one story is that the monk immediately acknowledged that he was wrong. He said, "I'm sorry." They said, "That's okay." He went back to his monastery. But then the monks at the Vinaya monastery started talking about it. "Hey, you know what that monk did? He left water in the basin. Can you believe it?" And this kind of escalated, and pretty soon everybody was talking about it. The other story is kind of the exact opposite. The monk refused to acknowledge it, and he said, "I never did that." And he argued about it, he pleaded his case, and he was excommunicated. He was thrown out. And blows were exchanged, and the townspeople got involved, and it was just this big, huge deal. So maybe there's a lesson in all of this. Maybe it's look after your own practice. Just saying. Then a certain bhikkhu went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, he sat down at one side and informed him what was happening. And the Buddha asked this monk to call all of the other monks together so he could address them. He says to them, "Bhikkhus, what do you think? When you take to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers, do you on that occasion maintain acts of loving kindness by body, speech, and mind, in public and in private, towards your companions in the holy life?" And the monks had to admit, "No, venerable sir." And then the Buddha says the following: "Misguided men, what can you possibly know? What can you see that you take to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes?" There's a little repetition here. There's a lot of repetition in these sutras, and I think it was an aid to memorization. If you hear the same thing over and over, you're going to walk away from the lecture and it's going to stick in your mind. So anyway, to back up a little bit. "Misguided men, what can you possibly know? What can you see that you take to quarreling and brawling and are deep in disputes, stabbing each other with verbal daggers? That you can neither convince each other nor be convinced by others, can neither persuade each other nor be persuaded by others. Misguided men, that will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time." So he's being pretty firm here. He's saying, knock it off. Sometimes this direct approach is good. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus: "Bhikkhus, there are six memorable qualities that create love and respect and conduce to helpfulness, to non-dispute, to concord, and to unity. What are the six?" And he goes through these six principles of cordiality. And they're listed on your program in the order that he gave them. I'm going to follow a commentator, Venerable Yu Vimala Ramsey, and talk about mental acts of loving kindness first, then verbal acts, then bodily acts, because I think that makes sense. First we think of being kind, then we verbalize it, then we act on it. So we'll start with this one. Here a bhikkhu maintains mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, towards his companions in the holy life. This creates love and respect, conduces to cohesion, non-dispute, concord, and unity. So mental acts of loving kindness, both in public and private, not just for show. You talk the talk, and you also walk the walk. towards his companions in the holy life. Why does the Buddha say that? Why doesn't he say toward everyone? I think that's because the companions in the holy life, the fellow monks, that's who these monks are seeing every day. They're not interacting that much with the townspeople. They might go out begging, they might do some teaching, but mostly they're just with the fellow monks. So I think that's why the Buddha says it that way. And I'm certain that the Buddha would want this loving kindness to be extended to all beyond the monastery as well. So maintaining mental acts of loving kindness. So I think that indicates it's not just deeds that are important. Your very thoughts are important. And cultivating your thoughts can actually help others. And how is it that we do this? How is it that we cultivate thoughts that will help others? I think the starting point is to see when we have loving thoughts and to see when we have thoughts that are not loving. And it may seem obvious that we're going to know this, but to really see these things right when they arise is kind of a rare gift. And I believe that with meditation, with a lot of meditation over time, we begin to see these things when they arise at their source. We may be sitting in a retreat, and something just comes up. We go, wow, there's that negative thought, that persistent negative thought I've been having for a long time. And you see it right at its source. When you see it right at its source, it's pretty easy to kind of let go of it again, or maybe bring in another thought, a more positive thought. And sometimes in a retreat, you might see your negative thoughts, your judgment, jealousy, anger, whatever, in kind of a raw form. And sometimes this isn't much fun, and sometimes you get a little tired of yourself for a while. But when you see it, you can very quickly invite in a kinder thought. And I think that's the way to do it. Invite in a kinder thought. Don't try to destroy or kill or stomp upon the angry thought. That's just going to create more anger. Just let that one go and bring in something pleasant. And I think when it comes to cultivating thoughts of loving kindness, practice can really ripen. And maybe things that repelled you at one time can ultimately be opportunities for loving kindness and not repel you, but actually open your heart. I've talked before about my visits to nursing homes, which I was doing a lot of about 2 years ago when my mother-in-law was in a nursing home, and how my attitudes got transformed. And I think maybe the first time I visited a nursing home, I was maybe 10 or 12 years old, and my great-grandmother was in a nursing home. And that was a long time ago, and it wasn't a very nice place. And I was really repelled by it. And really, I saw everyone suffering, and I think I saw my own suffering a lot, too. Just it makes me suffer to see this, you know. But then over the years, that changed, and I was able to get to the point where I actually love to go to nursing homes because I really see past all of that stuff that was so painful before, and I just see the pure beauty and life force of the people there, and it doesn't matter what they may be afflicted with or whatever. I just, you know, you see the pure humanity. Things ripen. They ripen over time, I think, as we get older, and I think they ripen with practice. We see the beauty in everyone. And so we cultivate this loving kindness. We cultivate these good thoughts. Other sorts of situations, angry people, mean people, that's not so easy. But practice can ripen there too. We may get angry a little less quickly than we did before. And we have this practice, which is a very proactive sort of cultivating loving kindness called metta practice, which many of you are familiar with, which it's kind of a conscious process where you're in meditation and you cultivate positive thoughts, first toward yourself, then toward someone you love very much, then someone you feel neutral toward, then someone that you are maybe really upset with. And that is a very wonderful practice. So that was mental acts of loving kindness. The next principle, a bhikkhu maintains verbal acts of loving kindness, both in public and private, etc. Verbal acts of loving kindness. And there's not very much that is mysterious here, what kind of acts those are. Expressing appreciation, kindness, or maybe simply understanding. Yes, I see you. Yes, I hear you. I know what you're saying. I don't have an answer, but I hear you. Verbal acts of loving kindness. My wife, Kathy, is so good at this. I've seen her just melt people. I've seen her melt people who are having a terrible day, and maybe they're in a pretty rough mood, and the last thing they want is one more person coming at them, bothering them, and she'll kind of draw them out. I remember one time we were up north, and we were staying at this little resort that we had found somewhere. And it was kind of on one of the big lakes. It was kind of on one of the small lakes. And it wasn't a very big resort, and there weren't many people there. We got the idea it wasn't maybe doing very well. And we went to check in, and the person at the counter looked like she was having a rough day and barely wanted to deal with this. And Kathy started asking her questions. So how long have you been at the resort? Well, about 3 years. And, oh, what did you do before that? Well, they were from the cities, and they had saved up for years, and this was their dream, and they got this resort. And she got her talking about it, and she talked about how they make their own furniture out of logs, and that's kind of unique. And she starts getting kind of excited about their life and feeling good about it again. Before you know it, she's called in her husband, and we're in the furniture shop where they make the furniture, and they're telling us all about it, and they're all excited. And I thought that was so sweet. I mean, she just really, I think, turned their day around just by listening, just by being verbal, just by being kind. So mental acts of loving kindness are one thing. Taking that leap into actually saying something, taking that risk, oh, maybe this person will just yell at me, taking that risk is a whole other thing. And I notice when she takes that risk, it almost always pays off. People do not say, you know, I don't want to talk about that now, or go away. Occasionally, but not really. And the third principle is maintaining bodily acts of loving kindness, both in public and in private, etc. So bodily acts, physical acts. This is doing stuff to express loving kindness. One of the simplest acts we can do to express loving kindness, as Bimala Ramsey points out, is to smile. Simply smile at someone. And sometimes you don't feel like smiling, and you can do it anyway. And scientific studies have shown that smiling actually has a transformative power. If you smile, you're going to feel better. So, hey, that's a pretty good practice, right? That's pretty easy. That's some pretty direct karma. It's like you smile, you feel better. So why not? It has this transformative power both for you and for the person who sees you. And he had this suggestion, and he probably wrote this before everyone had their phone with them all the time, but he says, when we talk on the phone, oftentimes our voice is kind of flat, and we're maybe not too excited and stuff because we're not smiling. We should place a mirror at the place where we talk on the phone and watch ourselves and note whether we're smiling or not. And if we actually try to smile while we're talking on the phone, it's going to make the conversation different. I would like to try that. So, bodily acts of loving kindness. I think of my brother, Jim, here. He's 2 years older than me, and he's a kind of a silent guy sometimes. Doesn't do a whole lot of talking. Not big on verbal acts of loving kindness. Not prone to telling me how great I am or how much he loves me. And mental acts of loving kindness, well, I don't know. I don't know if he's performing these at all. But physical acts, yes, consistently. My whole life he's been performing these acts. I think I am, as I've said before, an extraordinarily lucky person. I grew up in a stable, loving family. And a big part of that was having this big brother who was always there. There's this security I've had ever since I was really little that I just totally took for granted and didn't even know was there, because I have this bigger guy kind of watching out for me. The time I fully realized that was that in kind of a dramatic part of our life when our father was in a nursing home. He was in a nursing home for just a couple of weeks at the end of his life, but he was dying, and we knew that. And we were visiting him, and we were driving away just after lunchtime, I remember, and Jim was in front of me in this car, and I was behind him, and we were just driving down the road, and I remember just having this feeling, seeing his car in front of me, of like just having this protective shield, you know, protecting me. And I realized that it always been there all of my life. And that was really sweet. And that's because of the physical acts of kindness he had always done. Not a lot of talking. He just did the stuff that needed to be done to show that he cared. So those are mental, verbal, and physical acts. And there are three more. The next one, a bhikkhu uses things in common with his virtuous companions in the holy life. Without making reservations, he shares with them any gain of a kind that accords with the Dharma and has been obtained in a way that accords with the Dharma, including even the contents of his bowl, his food. So sharing any gain with others, if it's a gain that accords with the Dharma. Sharing stuff, not being too greedy. I think that applies to our society as a whole. I think it's really not moral to amass great quantities of wealth and not share it. Some people might disagree, and sometimes I think in our culture we kind of admire people who really amass wealth and then proceed to enjoy it. I'm not so sure. I think this is also about sharing the Dharma itself, about sharing oneself. So many people give of themselves around here. When I became ordained and I sewed my black robes, I never sewed a black rakasu. And it's customary to do that, and somehow I got out of doing that. I think I was just really busy with other things, and no one ever mentioned, hey, you're supposed to sew a black rakasu too. But nonetheless, some people here got together. It was Susan Nelson, Susan Hagler, and Stacy, and Matt Larson. And they sewed a black rakasu for me because I didn't have one, and they knew my shoe sew ceremony was coming up, and they thought I should have one. How kind was that? And I think they definitely obtained it in a way that accords with the Dharma. And then the fifth principle, again, a bhikkhu dwells both in public and in private, possessing in common with his companions in the holy life those virtues that are unbroken, untorn, unblotched, unmottled, liberating, commended by the wise, not misapprehended, and conducive to concentration. So, possessing virtues. As I said in my last talk, ethics, I think, is foundational in Buddhism. It's absolutely essential. So it's important to possess virtues, to do the right thing, to not take advantage of others in any way, and to possess these virtues in common with others. It's something we do together as a community, and that makes it easier because we support each other. Then the sixth principle, sixth and last, is to possess in common with your companions in the holy life that view that is noble and emancipating. To hold a view that is noble and emancipating. This is identical to right view on the Eightfold Path. And although one does not need to approach the elements of the Eightfold Path in any certain order, right view is usually listed first. And I think that's because it's kind of foundational, it's kind of a precursor to all of the others. And I think of right view as something deep and positive and personal. It's usually presented as accepting the truth of the Buddha's teachings, accepting the Four Noble Truths, and that kind of thing. But I like to think of it as something even more basic than that, something that one has before one even comes to Buddha's practice. I see right view as being the view that there is a better way to live, that there is a positive way to live. There is a better way to live than merely being reactive to what is thrown at us, than to just kind of bounce around according to what comes to us. The view that it's good to live life deliberately. And I think of Thoreau, who wrote that in Walden. He said, I went to the woods because I wish to live my life deliberately. And that line, even when I was quite young, just really had a great impact on me. And we all take it for granted, I think, that we have this positive view. But sometimes the value of this positive view really becomes apparent, and that's when it kind of goes away. When we get tired, when we say, maybe, I don't care. When we have really deep doubt. And maybe you've never had really deep doubt, and I hope you haven't, but for many people it happens. There's this kind of tragic doubt that comes in, and you say, I just don't know if I can do this anymore. I just don't know if I can continue to live my life deliberately. I think I'm just going to kind of give up, and I'm going to let things happen to me for a while. I'm just going to maybe kill the pain, and that's all, because that's how much it hurts. How can we avoid this tragedy? It's right here in the sutra. By possessing it in common with our companions in the holy life. By being part of a community. I know if I falter, if I'm down one day, that someone else is going to be up. And that person is going to inspire me. And I am constantly inspired by members of this community. It happens all the time. And usually they don't even know it. It happens in small ways and big ways. Like yesterday, I was here for a half-day retreat, and we were doing walking meditation, and we had so many people, we were using both rooms. And I was doing the walking meditation, and I think I probably looked very quiet on the outside, but on the inside, my mind was really kind of taking off there. And I remember just glancing at one person, a student here, just glancing at that person and just seeing something about the way he was walking. I can't even define it. I don't even know what it was. But something about that just really brought me back. Because he was focused at that moment. He was more focused than I was at that time. So your actions here can have a big effect on people. So next time you're in bed and it's 5 a.m. and it's Monday morning or Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday morning, and you're trying to decide whether to kind of snuggle back in or whether to drag yourself out of bed and take a shower and come here to Zen Center and do two sittings and some walking meditation and really put your heart into the service, know that your decision could change somebody's life that day. It really could happen. So the next part of this sutra really kind of surprised me because he says, of these six principles of cordiality, the chief, the most cohesive, the most unifying is this view, is this right view. And I thought, that's kind of strange that he would say out of all of these six, right view, sort of what you think in your own mind about this, is more important even than verbal or mental or physical acts of kindness. But I thought about that a little bit, and I think it makes sense. It says that my personal positive view of the world is the essential thing that holds all of this together. Because if I don't have that view, I'll stop being kind. I think this tells us that we have to cultivate our own spirit, our own bodhisattva spirit, our own life force, and our willingness to participate in life. I think this is a deep teaching about balance. You know, there are some folks who could give a lot more to others, but there are a lot of folks who really give a lot to others and could give a little more to themselves. A lot of folks in this building right now, I think. People who are so giving that they don't take time to rejuvenate themselves and get spread too thin and end up being no help to anyone. And yet they still hesitate to look after themselves because it seems selfish. But it is not. Please take care of yourselves. By caring for yourself, you are serving all beings. It's balance. It's the middle path. We have to be strong. We're in this for the long term. We want to be here in 20 years together still doing this, right? So let's not burn out. Let's do this in a sustainable way that'll help all beings. So I think this view that life is good, that life matters, that helping matters is what this community is all about. I think we do possess in common with our companions in the holy life that view that is noble and emancipating, and I think what could be more beautiful than that? And how could we be so lucky? We must have labored for innumerable kalpas in past lives with no thought of reward in order to get to this place. Don't you think? Yeah. So those are the six principles. And then there's more. After that, he asks, and how does this view that is noble and emancipating lead the one who practices in accordance with it to the complete destruction of suffering? Now he lists these seven things that are possessed by a person who takes the path, seven knowledges. So these are seven good things that will happen to you if you do this practice. Now, we often say, don't think about the results of your practice, but I guess the Buddha is not above kind of saying, hey, there'll be some results. You know, he's trying to draw you in a little bit, trying to get you to do it. First, the monk who practices these principles is freed from various obsessions: sensual lust, ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and remorse, doubt, speculation about this world, because you don't want to spend all of your time speculating about how things could be better, speculation about the other world, quarreling and brawling, being deep in disputes, stabbing others with verbal daggers. So he's coming back to the daggers. This is getting in another dig at the Kasambians. That's right, Kasambians. I'm not talking in abstractions here. I'm talking about you. Knock it off. So, freed from obsession, number two, you will obtain internal serenity. That's very nice. Number three, and this one I thought was a little odd, he or she will understand that there is no other recluse or Brahmin outside the Buddha's dispensation possessed of a view such as I possess. Dispensation here means a social or religious system, so it's an understanding that nobody really gets this except us Buddhists. And I thought that was pretty odd. It seems really religio-centric. I don't think that's an actual word, but you know what I mean. So it does seem a little odd, but perhaps it has something to do with respect for our own tradition, with the strength of our convictions. It certainly should not preclude respect for other religions, and I think Buddhism is not the only path to this kind of joy and serenity, but maybe that's just me. Fourth, the practitioner of these principles has the character of a person who possesses right view. So the character is that although you may commit some kind of offense, such as breaking the rules, still at once you can confess, reveal, and disclose it to the teacher or to wise companions in the holy life. And having done that, you enter upon restraint for the future. So we don't have to be perfect. We can stray and acknowledge that we've done so, and we can start over again. And apparently, this sutra has been debated a lot because there's this question about whether an enlightened person can make mistakes or not. I suspect they can, because I suspect the Buddha himself made at least one mistake, which was initially he did not admit women into the Sangha. It's just a mistake. That's what I think. But it's kind of a relief to know that everybody can make mistakes, isn't it? Fifth is another aspect of character, and that is, although you may be active in various matters for your companions in the holy life, so although you may be busy serving people in the Sangha around you, yet you have a keen regard for training in the higher virtue, etc. So a monk may greatly master cordiality and spend all of his or her time serving others in the Sangha, but still, if you do these practices, you'll be able to cultivate the higher virtues in yourself, and you won't lose your way yourself. And so he goes into this simile: just as a cow with a new calf can graze and still watch the calf at the same time, you'll be able to take care of yourself and take care of others at the same time. This is like parental mind. It's a wonderful thing to be able to have. Sixth is possessing the strength of someone who possesses right view. So what is this strength? The strength is when the Dharma is being taught, he heeds it, gives it attention, engages it with all his mind, hears the Dharma as with eager ears. So the more you devote yourself to the Dharma, the more you will be able to devote yourself to the Dharma. Well, that's pretty cool. And finally, the seventh is another aspect of the strength of one who has right view. The monk gains inspiration in the meaning, gains inspiration in the Dharma, gains gladness connected with the Dharma. Inspiration and gladness. So, not a bad deal. And then the sutra ends with the Buddha saying that when a noble disciple has these seven factors, these seven attributes, he or she possesses the fruit of stream entry. Stream entry is the first level of awakening, when one has entered the stream which flows inevitably to nirvana. Again, this is part of the Pali Canon. This is pre-Zen. We tend not to talk about levels of awakening in Zen, but here they do. So you possess these seven qualities, you've entered the stream which leads inevitably to nirvana. So that's it. That's cordiality. And we could ask, if you do these practices, is it going to help our society at large? Is it going to reduce the number of quarrelsome comments on the internet? Well, I think it might. I think it might. Because there is a ripple effect from our kind acts. And I think if we are especially kind and especially not quarrelsome, it's got to affect the people around us. And it's even going to affect the internet ultimately. And all of society will benefit. And even if we can't be sure that's going to happen, I think we're still going to do it. Beings are numberless, vowing to freedom. So that's what I have to say, and I would welcome comments or questions if anyone has one. Please be cordial. Hopefully I've insulated myself here from, I'm not going to have any vicious verbal daggers, but we'll see. Yes.
I just wanted to say, with the whole smiling thing, you know, how when you smile it makes you happier, it made me think of another thing that I read in a book once, that when you look up, it actually lifts you up as well.
Really?
Yeah, just looking up.
That's interesting. Yeah, double whammy. Yeah, I think that's true. You know, I've noticed that sometimes I'm walking, my head's down a little bit, and I straighten up, you know?
Yeah.
And good posture helps too. I mean, good posture is really conducive to what we do here. There's something about straightness of the back and something about the flow of energy in the body that makes a huge difference.
It's funny you said that because my back is kind of sore from sitting up because I'm used to like leaning.
Right,
like this,
so right. Like, oh. Yeah, we start out this way,
yeah.
And then we're meditating and we straighten up and it's really hard. But there's something really great about it, mm-hmm. You know. And you get to the point where you don't have to make yourself do it anymore. It's like, yeah, it's happening. You know, it's like the universe is moving through you, seriously, and it makes you want to sit up straight. Well, thanks for that comment. Anyone else? Yes, Jerry.
I was thinking that with the mental, the verbal, and the physical acts of loving kindness, I think it takes a lot of practice to do those for yourself,
mm-hmm.
Before it can go out to others.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's yeah. Just my experience.
Yeah. And why are we
start here before I can sort of authentically give it to others?
Why are we so hesitant to do these practices for ourselves? I wonder. But I think that can be really hard. So my theory, one theory. Well, sometimes it can come from outside of us, you know. Sometimes someone may tell us that we're not so good or worthwhile. But I think it can come from ourselves. I think we learn early on that if we're really tough on ourselves, we get results. If I'm really kind of mean to myself and berate myself in order to get this task done, I'll probably get the task done. In the short run, that might work. But in the long run, it's just really destructive. It's just really not helpful. Yeah, and you cannot. Yes. Yeah, go ahead. Let's see if I can get back to my thought. You can. You cannot do this practice unless you really just accept, I think, complete, unequivocal love toward yourself. If you're holding something back and somehow feel that you're not lovable, you're someone not worthy of love, you cannot really be free and you cannot really give love to others. So it's absolutely essential. It's absolutely essential. Just remember someone who is very kind in your life, someone who loved you unequivocally, like I might think of my grandmother, and just remember, she was right. She was right. So honor her, okay? You are as perfect as she thought you were. Okay.
I just want to say I really like the story about your wife. Mm-hmm. Listening. I think that's so important. And another piece of that has come up for me is about acknowledging people's feelings. As a parent, a lot of times, you know, our children will say, you know, I'm cold or I'm hungry, and we have this tendency to say, you're not hungry, you just ate. Or, you know, oh, you can't be cold, it's warm in here. You know, and that acceptance of the loving kindness to accept people's feelings of how they are. Oh, this person could be cold, this person could be hungry, this person could be sad. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I can see you are. And that just gives, it's also, like you said, to yourself first, you know, saying, oh, I can be sad in this moment, and acknowledging that as well with people in your own life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, well said. Thank you. And Linda, did you have something?
Yeah, thanks. I didn't realize how much I aspire to be a cow and how I never look at cows.
All right. Anything else? All right. Well, thank you so much for listening this morning. And I'll turn it over to Dave.